Welcome to week number six. This is the podcast based upon the newsletter that we write on a weekly basis for Rexilon. It's myself, Kirby Lachrunji, and Dawn Riddler. What is the newsletter? Well, the newsletter, really speaking, is an encapsulation of the week's events. We touch politics. We touch on anything anecdotal that could be influencing markets. We touch on markets, company results, and anything that we've seen during the week that you might find interesting. Reach out to us. Let us know what you're reading about. And if you want a lot more information about what we are going to be talking about here today, please feel free to head over to our newsletter. Get your friends to subscribe. It's something that we're going to be doing every single week, barring for 2 or 3 weeks in December. We do it literally all of the time. So week number six, as I said, we're going to be talking about the South African state of the nation. We're going to head overseas and talk a little bit about the Magnificent Seven stocks. Those are the very large tech-heavy stocks. We're going to talk about companies that potentially that we've owned or own, Hermes being one of those, PayPal being a different one. Load shedding in South Africa is an ongoing issue. We're going to chat about that. And then Dawn has written an amazing blog, which we're going to spend a bit of time on today, about how to lock in the higher interest rates that we've experienced during 2023. And just before we start, let's just have a look at markets. So for the week, the Dow Jones has ended up 2.87%, the S&P 500 up 5.80%, the tech-heavy NASDAQ up 6.80%, showing again how strenuously that Magnificent Seven has been rising in price. The Euro Stoxx 50 is up 5.25% for the week. And then if we hand over to the Eastern market, Shanghai down 0.34%, just can't catch a break. And if we look at the component, the Shenzhen component index, down 1.95%. So quite a different world, and that really has been the case since the year started. Rand dollar so far 19.05. The rand against the pound 24.03 against the euro closed at 20.53. And then Bitcoin in weekend trading almost up at $48,100 per Bitcoin. Most of that probably is due to the ETF market that has now adopted the Bitcoin. And for today, one can get exposure into Bitcoin through an exchange-traded fund. So, Dawn, let's start with the state of the nation. It really was a damp squib, right?
It always is, Kobe. It's really just become a platform for the ruling party to make empty promises. I mean, there's quite a bit in some of the newspapers and that, sort of giving a bit of a history and what's been promised in SONA and what has actually transpired. And the results are actually abysmal. You know, serious pundits have really written it off as anything other than another sort of like Queen's speech. In fact, the Queen's speech is usually more meaningful than SONA is. And even the sort of fashion parade and everything that we used to see pre-pandemic, that's kind of fizzled out, which is a good thing in many respects. I mean, we really don't want to see our politicians spending an awful lot of money on designer clothes and that kind of thing, that, you know, they're not fooling anybody. But what I found, I started writing, you know, sort of starting to put my ideas together for this newsletter on about Friday night and yesterday early morning. And by lunchtime, we were in stage six again. I had already started to write about load shedding and it's, you know, we're doing more maintenance and there's more IPP, and then suddenly we're in stage six again, right on the back of SONA. It's just appalling. Having looked at that, I was really very happy to see how much the private sector has picked this up and is running with it. The private sector, in terms of businesses and personal, we're looking at 6,000 megawatts being produced.
Yeah.
If you consider the 1,000 megawatts is approximately one stage of load shedding, that is considerable and not really factored into Eskom's figures they're putting out there. One of the things that I found exceptional was the amount of wind power that is actually being produced is way higher than I thought. It's, you know, at its best, it's about 3.5 megawatts. And that's huge. And it is now being constrained by the sheer fact that Eskom does not have sufficient capacity to transmit this power. That's where the private sector, for the individual use of being able to look after their individual use, but they're not being able to feed that excess into the system because of the constraints from Eskom's point of view. And the other thing that I picked up, I look at this a lot, I suppose having been a scientist in my previous life, I find this fascinating. Got my own solar system. I looked at it in a lot of detail, and I encourage anybody who's getting solar system to actually really understand some of the physics behind solar so that you can maximize your personal use out of it, is to get an understanding of just where this is going and what the constraints are. I mean, we did very briefly talk a little bit about green hydrogen, and green hydrogen is another one where, and it's run off solar systems because we don't want to use electricity to do the electrophoresis for green hydrogen. But there again, we're going to be constrained by the logistics behind it, is actually getting that green hydrogen to the places that it's needed, in order to consume that hydrogen. Boils down to our biggest problem at this point in time is nuts and bolts. It's logistics. It's not having the railways. It's not having the ports. It's not having the electrical power lines. Never mind the power stations. It's the sheer transporting of whether it's electricity, whether it's coal, or whether it's containers or whatever else it is. I mentioned in my note in the newsletter last week, I was running Michael Avery's show for him on Wednesday and Thursday this last week. And one of the constraints that Simon Brown actually mentioned, which is really interesting, is Kumba iron ore. We are a commodity nation. Kumba iron ore are sitting on huge stockpiles of iron ore because it just can't get it to the ports to be exported. And you can't sort of just keep putting it on trucks and that, because that erodes your margin at the end of the day, because it's not a high value commodity.
So, Dawn, here's the question. I mean, you've lived in many parts of Africa. You've seen democracy happen in many African countries across the world. And in some cases, they turn the corner. And in some cases, they just don't. I think a good example of that would be Zimbabwe, which just continues to dig the hole and they continue just to get deeper and deeper and deeper. What is it that a country, what is that turning point? Why should people be optimistic in South Africa or pessimistic for that matter?
From what I've seen in places like Kenya, Kenya got its independence in 1964. Just like South Africa post 1994, they didn't spend any money on maintenance. No, there was no money spent on maintenance of roads, of railways, hydroelectric dams, as well in Kenya. We don't have quite that same problem here in this country, but hydroelectric dams have to be dredged in order that there's sufficient water going over the weir in order to produce hydroelectric energy. It took circa 30 years for them to reach the bottom of the hole and to realize that they had to stop digging or they were going to lose all their revenue. Now, in Kenya's case specifically, the revenue that they were starting to lose hand over fist was tourism. People just did not want to come to the game parks on the Kenyan coast when there's no electricity, there's no water, they can't get to the game park because literally some of the main roads were down from being double lane highways to one way in one direction, small strip of tarmac, and everybody's playing chicken on this road. Who's going to get off the tarmac road? So it comes to that realization, and it seems to take 30 years or so for everybody to have had their go at the trough, had their nose in the trough, and their tribe or their race or their whatever it is has now had their fill at the trough, had their fill at the trough, not just of money, but of power and being able to wield the power and having presidential and this kind of thing. The thing is with Zimbabwe is that you've only had one ruling party in power. Nobody else has had, except for maybe, here and there occasionally, and in this country, we've got w far more varied interests in that. So, but this merry-go-round hasn't happened. So it comes to a point where we start losing money, and now we're losing money on exports. There is a bill now going through the US Congress, thanks to us not minding our own business when it comes to Gaza, trying to get AGOA superseded. So, it boils down to when we start running out of money that other people want to give us. Governments, and irrespective, and I think this goes back probably centuries, they really don't care about their people suffering. It's when they aren't getting enough money to do the bits and pieces that they want and they lose power that things happen. I think that probably the breakdown of the British Empire is a good example of that.
Perhaps we're going to look back in time at this whole thing that happened at the ICC with Israel, where South Africa took Israel to court, for, trying to declare the thing happening in the Gaza Strip a genocide. Perhaps we look back in time at that event and we say that was a pivotal moment for South Africa, because that might be the moment where the international community saw South Africa for who they are, and suddenly the funding dried up. And perhaps that is the pivotal changing point. Perhaps. That will only know in the future. The one thing I can tell you, it's 30 years since democracy. And in 30 years, let's see where all of that ends up. Dawn, you've written quite an interesting blog about locking in interest rates. Obviously, for retired individuals, high interest rates is fantastic because they can earn higher rates of interest on fixed income instruments. And the whole blog, if you head over to MoneyWeb, you can go and read it there. You can head over to the Rexlon website. You could read it there. And then inside the newsletter, there's links to each one of those if you wish to read those as well. Why is locking in interest rates so important? Well, firstly, if you're retired and you want to make an or create an income for yourself, then this is a pretty risk-free way to be able to do so by now buying instruments that only 2 or 3 years ago were yielding much less than what they're yielding today. And in South Africa, the good news is that yields are even higher than what they are internationally. So you could even lock in yields at even higher levels. Obviously, diversification and all of those good things are important. And that's obviously why, what we do as a business, that's obviously one of the things that we try and achieve for clients. But don't, I mean, interest rates globally this year will go down. We will start seeing rates slowly decreasing. And as those rates decrease, that opportunity will slowly ebb away.
Kobe, what is really interesting is that I have a couple of clients where we put them when the interest rates last peaked about 5 years ago, just prior to COVID. So it's about 5 years ago. They wanted to be in, there for the capital to be safe. I think that's one of the things that people consider when you're using any kind of fixed income is the preservation of
Yes.
capital. A couple of my clients went into these high yielding, and this is where you've got to understand the difference between simple interest, nominal interest and compounded interest. Some, quite frankly, dubious actors out there who shall remain nameless, but they're logos are usually colored green, will say, we'll give you an interest rate of 13.5%, when in fact it's actually maybe 10.5% compounded on a daily basis, which after 5 years will give you 13.5%. So it both of those, for those few clients that locked in those interest rates 5 years ago, they weathered the storm right through COVID when interest rates dropped right through the floor. They still were getting those, 10.5% on an annual basis returns coming in. Those are now maturing right now at the same levels that when they went in 5 years
Oh,
ago,
fantastic.
which is really
Perfect.
great.
Perfect.
And really great, especially for the clients that didn't take an income from it, because that is now compounded. It has gone through a very rocky phase. Yes, they have lost some of the growth in the market in the interim. But the one caveat, obviously, all the time with a fixed income, when you're taking that actual income, is that unless you're putting some of it back, or you're taking some and putting it somewhere else back, you are preserving the capital, but that capital loses its purchasing power over time.
And I mean, look, this is important to understand as well. You get two classes of bonds. The one is what we call a floating rate note, and the other one's a fixed rate note. A floating rate note is bonds which tend to fluctuate with interest rates. So when interest rates go up, the yield goes up, and when the yields come down, the yield that you're going to get comes down. But the price of them are, is basically fixed. Those are often corporate bonds in the South African world. Floating rate notes, that's how they operate. They've got a term attached to them. And if you can get those at really decent yields, those are fantastic. Dawn, I'm looking at auctions now of floating rate notes, and they're coming in probably less than what you're going to get out of government bonds. Government bonds in South Africa is very well priced from that perspective. And they obviously those were different to a floating rate notes because they're fixed rate notes, because the price now fluctuates with the level of interest. And then obviously, if you want to earn that level of interest that you're purchasing it at, you've got to own it till maturity. The good news is obviously is, and this is part of the thinking out there, is as rates drop, you're going to get some capital appreciation in the bond because the bonds should go up in value as rates drop overseas. Now, remember that South Africa is priced as an emerging market. That's the first thing. So the yields here are higher than what they are internationally. But if rates drop internationally, the Federal Reserve pushes yields lower. That's good news because South African bonds will tend to go lower as well. To always have a margin that you can earn over Federal Reserve bonds, but you will get that. And remember, for the South African government to default on bonds, it is entirely possible. It can happen. But remember, this would be a major default. We're talking about Treasury defaulting on their bonds, and that is a major shift for government. And it would literally, they'll become the pariah of the investment world as far as fixed income is concerned. It's not a place that you want to be. It's not a place you want to be. And I think that the day they default, you've got much bigger issues in South Africa than worrying about the bonds that are defaulting. I always say that to investors.
Just to add in there, the South Africa has defaulted on sovereign debt 3 times. All three times were during the previous administration, during the nationalist government. The last time was actually in 1994. For 30 years, we have not seen a default. So it would be a huge departure. You know, it would put us back in the same sort of category as the sort of Venezuelans and Argentinas and these kind of people who default on a regular basis.
Hey, Dawn, one of the things that we must talk about at some point, and this is perhaps just for the listeners, we're going to be doing this, is looking at the reforms that Javier Milei is making in Argentina. He's the new president of that country. He is pushing through reforms like people are eating potatoes at Sunday lunches. It is amazing to see the amount of stuff that's busy happening. And look, I think it's going to be hard yards, but we'll see. We're going to do a blog on that. We're going to be talking about that because that's really interesting. Dawn, I wrote a piece this week called The Curse of Growth because the Magnificent Seven is, which is these large tech heavy businesses are just stratospheric in their valuations and stratospheric in their price appreciation since last year. And a lot of investors are looking at this and saying, gosh, you know what? I should just have gotten involved in these stocks. And why didn't I? Why didn't I do so at size? Because look at how much money I could have made right now. And the piece that I've written is called The Curse of Growth because the curse of growth, and I reference a company called PayPal when I look at a growth company. PayPal is interesting because it used to be a growth company. This is a company that was going to be the revolutionary company in the payments industry. It was going to take on MasterCard and Visa. It was going to revolutionize this whole industry, and you would be stupid not to invest your money into something like PayPal. Now, they came out with their fourth quarter revenue numbers last week. Revenue there increased by 9%, topped estimates. It didn't look that bad. And most people kind of would have thought, well, they're right-sizing the organization. They're going to buy back stock. The stock price should increase in value. Well, actually, after trade, the stock was down 8%. And really speaking, it was due to the number of active accounts that have slowly started decreasing. So they can't show yet that the number of active accounts that are housed inside PayPal is increasing. And this is now what has got the stock almost spooked. But if you go back in time, PayPal is really a storied success over time. You know, we're going back to days when Elon Musk was involved with PayPal. And we saw a major growth in the stock. You know, the stock 2016, you know, trading even lower than where it is today. And then we saw the stratospheric rise in the stock price all the way up kind of the end of 2022. This stratospheric rise in the stock price is what a lot of people during that time would have said, well, why wasn't I involved in this company? Why didn't I get involved in something like this? And why didn't I buy it at weight? And that's basically the same story as the Magnificent Seven today, because once they show that they can't keep the momentum and they can't keep the momentum of subscriptions and revenue and all of these other things going, the stock price just basically drops in value. And that is part of what has now happened with PayPal. As I said last week, the company was down significantly in value, now trading at about $56. Remember, the height of the stock was beyond $200. So we're talking about a stock that has really fell quite significantly. Back in 2016, the stock was at $30. So 56, you've still made money, but nothing like the long-term compounding effect that one wants to see out of companies. And actually, the truth of the matter is that a lot of what is happening inside PayPal actually has got to do with their returns on invested capital, Dawn.
I urge anybody who's listening to this to go to the newsletter and read that focus bit that you did there, Corby, because it will give people maybe who perhaps aren't our clients and haven't invested with us a good idea of the kind of thinking that goes into the shares that you choose to go into portfolios. And, that is a very valuable insight, especially if you've got an interest in shares and say, how does Corby determine, whether we should buy Hermes or Louis Vuitton or whatever else it is?
Yeah,
And
correct.
that focus bit, without you saying so explicitly, and forgive me for saying so explicitly, it gives an indication of the kind of thinking that what we think is important in a share before we put it into a portfolio. And as you quite rightly say in the focus piece, what weighting you give it in
Yeah, and
that portfolio.
the weighting is critical, because once you've distilled an investment case, which is not always cut and dry. It's not it's always cut and dry. I mean, it's interesting, Dawn, because I own PayPal at a lower weighting inside the Worldwide Flexible Fund, but we don't necessarily own it through all the portfolios. And that just shows the narrative of a company and what and the type of investor that is different to maybe one of our bespoke clients. And then again, the weighting is incredibly important. I go into detail on how we actually go about actually thinking about weighting, a methodology and understanding how one needs to weight a company. If you don't do that, then you get sucked up into the narrative. And I'm going to leave it at that, because I think there's a lot of information that is in the newsletter, and I urge people to go and read up about it. Reach out to us, chat to us about PayPal. Tell us about your biases that you potentially have when it comes to investing. If you read the PayPal piece, you'll see how we try and guard against narratives and biases that we've ourselves have built up over time and that we might ourselves have. Well, that's week number six. Thank you for joining us.